You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Sharon Harrigan's new novel, entitled Half, is a story about twins coming of age in an abusive family set in Michigan. It tracks the two sisters' almost mystical connection and how their bond breaks down under the pressure of their father's antagonism and the mystery surrounding their family's story. The book was chosen as a first runner-up for the AWP Novel Prize. Sharon Harrigan grew up in Michigan and now lives in Virginia. She previously published a memoir called Playing with Dynamite. Sharon Harrigan, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So your protagonists are twins, Artis and Paula, named approximately for the divine Greek twins, Artemis and Apollo, the Greek gods who were also twins. And they have this really complicated relationship with their father, who was very hard on them, abusive really, both physically and psychologically. You're not a twin, are you?
No, I'm not.
Okay. How did you settle on twins?
Yeah, it was a process. I didn't start out thinking I was going to write about twins. I started out thinking I wanted to write about a close relationship, about intimacy and about empathy. And I was very close to my brother when I was growing up. We were a year and a half apart. And it seemed normal back then, but now it seems kind of magical. And so I started writing about siblings because they share biology, they share environment. It seems like for a platonic relationship, they have the possibility to have the closest bond. So I wrote at first I wrote about this girl and a boy who are brother and sister. But then as I took the idea of intimacy further and further, so that they actually became almost indistinguishable and people at least thought they were, couldn't tell them apart, I realized that I had to actually make them both girls, and then further than that, make them twins. So I took this thing from my life and exaggerated it, hoping that that would make the idea clearer.
I think a lot of people wish for a twin in wishing for someone who understands them completely. And yet I know there are twins who don't get along.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like these two do. Would you read from the beginning of the book for us?
Sure. The beginning of chapter one. We wanted to crawl back in time. Even then, we were only five, but that wasn't young enough. The more we played this game, hovering outside our parents' door after dinner, trying to hear their mysterious bedroom sounds while pretending we didn't, the more we wanted to be babies again, or even to slip back into our mother's belly, the way we slid into her bed those nights when Dad was away on a hunting trip. I'm half years old, we said. How old are you? I'm half two. At first, we had been alive 6 months, just half a year. Later, half no longer stood for anything, half empty, half full. We babbled and baby talked the way our own children do now when they don't want us to understand. Our friend Nevaeh had a baby brother, and he was always sucking at his mother's breast. So we knew milk was food. Milk was love.
Like a lot of twins, Artis and Paula have a great deal that passes between them that other people don't understand. You said you wanted to explore intimacy. What appeals to you about having that kind of narration about a shared understanding?
Well, it's kind of a metaphor made literal of people feeling so close that they can read each other's minds, like a married couple who are so close they can finish each other's sentences. And I take that idea and actually say, yes, I'm going to make it a literal thing. What I love about my first book was memoir, so I was really stuck with having to stay with the facts. And what I love about fiction is the ability to take something that maybe can start with the literal truth and stretch it so that it can even become kind of magical. And you can see that idea, I think, in a new way. The point of view is kind of magical. It's not possible for two people to speak as one, to think as one. And so I get to explore this idea through fiction, which allows us to go beyond the literal truth.
The book narrates their family life from a very early age, and it feels like the twins are on to the fact that their dad is pretty awful very early in their lives. Do you think that that kind of literal understanding is... Do you observe that that's the case for kids suffering from abuse?
So I didn't suffer from abuse as a child, but I had a traumatic experience, which is that my father died when I was seven. I think that's part of what made my brother and me so close, is that we were trying to survive this traumatic experience together and feeling like kind of no one knew what was going on. And we couldn't put it into words, but when we were with each other, we didn't have to put it into words. We just kind of were together. And that almost felt like reading each other's thoughts. And so I do, because I had this traumatic event happen to me at such a young age, I have very vivid memories of what it feels like to be that young and how I just didn't understand anything. Like, what was magic? What was real? What was death? You know, were our parents gods? Would they live forever? And I kind of promised myself that I would remember what that felt like to be a kid. And now, you know, I have kids myself. I'm fascinated to see how they really are living in a different kind of world and having different experiences than adults do.
A lot of the grist of the book is following Artis and Paula from their childhood and this very vivid experience they're having of joy and fear into their adult lives. What interested you in talking about that transition growing from childhood and a very difficult childhood into adulthood? What did you have to figure out how to say?
Well, another thing that I think fiction does so well is show the characters changing, their personal growth, their epiphanies, how they can analyze events and see them differently. They change. That's the arc of a novel. I set it up so that you sort of see the narrators, the twins' lives happening in real time. There's one chapter for every year from ages 5 to 22 as they are looking through their childhood themselves, their 30-year-olds, at their father's funeral, trying to understand exactly what happened in their childhood and who's to blame for this sort of murder mystery. So I liked having the reader get to see as they remember and they come to different conclusions. So, you know, they had kind of these set ideas of what happened in their lives. But then as they analyze them retrospectively, they actually come up with different ideas. And I think it's so easy for us to keep these ideas of what happened in our lives, to have these memories be things that never change, that we never question. So in fiction, it's an opportunity to have my characters question what happened and question their memories and grow and change and have a bigger understanding than they had before. Mm-hmm. And I hope readers will be inspired to think to do the same thing in their own life.
Do you mind talking about the point at which you were sort of going through that, I guess, interrogation process of your own experience?
So my father died when I was 7. We didn't really talk about it much, and I never really understood what happened. But then there was this moment when my daughter turned 8 at her 8th birthday party, when I was thinking that my father never got to see me turn 8. And I wrote a blog post about it, and that kind of snowballed into my brother responding, my mother responding, and everybody in my family sort of starting to talk about this again and telling me stories. And then I started to investigate, well, so what actually did happen? How did he die? How did he blow off his right arm playing with dynamite? What does playing with dynamite mean? So it was really kind of having my own kids that made me look back at what it was like when I was a kid.
And it seems like you discovered through that process that kind of everybody needed to talk about it.
Yes, I thought it was taboo that I was not supposed to talk about. What I found out was that my mother was waiting for me to show signs that I was ready to talk about it.
Can I ask you to read from a little later segment of the book?
Yeah, at this point, they are 30 years old. They have 5-year-old children themselves. The book begins when they are 5. Now they have their own 5-year-olds. And they are both living far away from Michigan. One of them is a singer in New York City, and one of them is in the Army. It started with the call that came the same time every year, "Come home." We could almost hear Mom lean into the palm that held her cell, almost see her other hand twisting a ringlet that had fallen from her bun, legs jiggling with enough nervous energy to light a window display. "Please come see your family for Christmas." We wanted to make her happy, but we didn't want to see Dad. So we said, "Not this time, maybe next year." Our throats burned with the rawness of our lies. Mom told our sons that Michigan was the land of perpetual snow, so they begged us to take them there. She didn't admit that these snowstorms were monstrous. 10 years had passed since our meteorology professor said they would be. Not every place had warmed. In Michigan, the weather just became weirder. "The state is even shaped like a giant mitten," Mom said. The boys spun around and around, littering the floor with shredded paper, shouting, "White Christmas!" Then we texted each other, "Wish we could take the boys to Michigan." We could, if Dad was gone.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sharon Harrigan. She's reading to us from her new novel. It's called Half.
And this is also, to be clear, the novel is set 10 years in the future, so in 2030. And by this time, the snow has become kind of mythically weirder and weirder. I'm kind of foreseeing some climate change that is a little bit exaggerated, but has a grain in what might happen.
So there's some speculative fiction there, too.
Yes, yes.
Right. So when you get to this point of Artis and Paula trying to figure out, you know, who their father really was, what was his deal, and why did their mother stay with him for as long as she did, and what were her reasons for not, I guess, protecting them a little bit better? I mean, those are some pretty painful places to take your characters.
Yeah, I think they go to some deep emotional places. I hope that in the end it feels cathartic to readers to go to those deep places and come out the other end.
If we could just switch gears for a minute. You grew up, as we said, in Michigan, but you're living in Charlottesville, Virginia right now. Was there anything particular to Michigan that you wanted in this book?
I mean, you know, Michigan is my heart. So I grew up in the Detroit area, southwest, downriver in Lincoln Park. But my grandparents came from northern Michigan, Kalkaska, and they still had an unfinished house that we would spend time there in the summer. And my father spent a lot of time in northern Michigan hunting and in the woods, and was very much his soul. He was in the city, you know, because of work, but it was the country in northern Michigan that was really his soul. And so it's my soul too. And I feel so connected to this place.
This is the kind of conversation that I think a lot of people who've grown up in the Midwest and then leave may have at some point, or who, you know, if people have children who've grown up in the Midwest and leave, they have that conversation with their kids. although it means some different things for Artis and Paula than it does for just about everybody. Have you had that conversation yourself? You know, parents longing to see children who sometimes have had really valid reasons for trying to get away.
Yes, I think that is something that I think it's painful probably for the parents whose children don't come home as much as they wish they did. And frankly, I'm sure that I have not always come home as much as most of my cousins, most of my family is still in Michigan. And so I think my parents would be happy if I was closer by and came home more often.
What did you want to show about how the twins had to figure out their own relationship with where they were from, with their need to?
Because it is who they are. It's their identity. And also, you know, their father names them after these Greek gods because he wants them to feel like this is their fate, that they should become these kind of heroic figures, these larger-than-life people. And they kind of fight against that. He teaches them how to play guitar by ear when they're five, and he teaches them all these physical stuff that he learned in the army. And so he kind of passes on to them all the powers that he has, and they fight against that. But in the end, they actually realize that they are what he thought they would be. They kind of do fulfill their fate. They are kind of where they came from and who they came from. That is who they are. That's their identity. And they feel that pull that they can't escape it.
I just wanted to ask a thing or two about the place where you're living right now, Charlottesville, Virginia. Charlottesville has been touched, I guess, as much as any American city by the issues that have been raised by Black Lives Matter. And it was the place where a 2017 white supremacist rally ended with the killing of one person who was a counter-protester. It was a really intense moment, and it helped to set the stage for some of the protests, I think, in the country right now. I just wondered what things are like in Charlottesville at this moment.
Yeah, that's a really good question because, of course, we can't forget what happened on August 12th. It's an interesting time to be in Virginia. Just the other day, my husband and I went to Richmond, which, of course, was the capital of the Confederacy. And Monument Avenue is where the monuments for all the Confederate generals are. And now that we have a legislature that is going to allow the localities in Virginia to remove their monuments, it is going to happen. It hasn't quite happened yet. But what has happened is that there's been this public defacement, and all the monuments have spray painted Black Lives Matter all over them. And when we were there on Saturday, there were people giving speeches, there were marches, there were food trucks, there was music. And what's kind of amazing is it's change is happening. And so people are actually, the mood, I think, was very, very somber at first after the death of George Floyd. And still there's a lot of grief, but there is a sense here, I think, that that's the catalyst. George Floyd's cousin was there speaking. Things actually are now starting to change, and there's a little bit of feeling of hope.
When you think about how growing up in Michigan has shaped how you move through this world, what comes to mind?
Well, being up north with my grandparents, that was just a magical time where we would go in walks in the woods, and they had these pipelines that were now covered with blackberry vines, and we would put out salt for the deer. And so to me, it's just this beautiful place of wildness. And then I think Detroit is like one of the most fascinating places in America. Of course, now, you know, with what's happening with Black Lives Matter, you know, there's been a lot happening in historically in Detroit related to race relations, too. There's a lot that's hopeful.
Well, Sharon Harrigan, thank you so much for the book. It's really lovely. And thanks for talking to us about it.
Oh, thank you so much. I loved your questions. Thank you for reading.
Author Sharon Harrigan. Her new novel is called Half. She has an online author event Wednesday night presented by Literati Books in Ann Arbor. If you're interested in connecting, just check the Literati webpage. Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.